Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Tonight we're bringing you episode 30 of Adolf Hitler's After Lunch and Dinner Table Conversations that were taken down in shorthand by Heinrich Heim and Henry Picker under the direction of Martin Bormann. Tonight we're going to start, not in the first segment, but in a later one with Henry Picker as the note taker. Doesn't seem to make any difference. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my co-host is Ray Goodwin, and I'm waiting for him to call, but I'm not seeing a call light up on the board.
Hello there.
Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show. As I said, we're going to have Henry Picker starts tonight on the 21st of March, I think. Not that it makes any difference, but he becomes the note taker at this point for a few months, I think. So that's something. But we're starting in March 1942, and what is the date we're starting at?
It's the night of the 10th and 11th.
Okay. All right. Well, you go ahead, and I'm going to fill that in there. I have to ask you, I have to put it in for several of them tonight.
Sure. Okay. We'll begin with the night of 10th, 11th, March 1942. Feminine jealousy is a defensive reaction. Some stories about women. In woman, jealousy is a defensive reaction. It surely has an ancestral origin and must go back to the time when woman simply couldn't do without the protection of a man. First of all, it's the reaction of a pregnant woman who, as such, has all the more need of protection. She feels so weak in those circumstances, so timid for herself and for the child she's carrying. And this child itself, how many years will it take to gain its independence? Without the protection of a man, woman would feel exposed to all perils, so it's natural that she should be quite particularly attached to the hero, to the man who gives her the most security. Once this security is obtained, it's comprehensible that she should bitterly defend her property, hence the origin of jealousy. Man is inspired by a similar feeling towards the woman he loves, but the realm of feminine jealousy is infinitely vaster. A mother is jealous of her daughter-in-law, a sister of her sister-in-law. I was present one day at a scene that Eva Chamberlain made at the expense of her brother, Siegfried Wagner. It was absolutely incredible, the more so as they were both married. Siegfried's young wife, Winifred, was, so to speak, tolerated by her sisters-in-law. Nevertheless, on the day of the catastrophe, her presence was thought particularly opportune. She was a woman of irreproachable behavior. Siegfried owes her four handsome children, all of them obviously his, all of them Wagner's. One day I detected an unexpected reaction even in Frau Bruckmann. She had invited to her house, at the same time as myself, a very pretty woman of Munich society. As we were taking our leave, Frau Bruckmann perceived in her female guest's manner a sign of an interest that she doubtless deemed untimely. The consequence was that she never again invited us both at once. As I've said, the woman was beautiful, and perhaps she felt some interest in me, nothing more. I knew a woman whose voice became raucous with emotion when I spoke in her presence to another woman. Man's universe is vast compared with that of woman. Man is taken up with his ideas, his preoccupations. It's only incidental if he devotes all his thoughts to a woman. Woman's universe, on the other hand, is man. She sees nothing else, so to speak, and that's why she's capable of loving so deeply. Intelligence in a woman is not an essential thing. My mother, for example, would have cut a poor figure in the society of our cultivated women. She lived strictly for her husband and children. They were her entire universe, but she gave a son to Germany. Marriages that originate only in sensual infatuation are usually somewhat shaky. Such bonds are easily untied. Separations are particularly painful when there has been a genuine comradeship between man and wife. I think it improper that a woman should be liable to be called upon to give evidence in court on intimate matters. I've had that abolished. I detest prying and espionage. That reminds me of a characteristic of Frederick the Great. He was complaining one day to his chief of police that he was the worst informed monarch in Europe concerning what went on inside his kingdom. "Nothing would be easier, sire. Put at my disposal the methods that my colleagues have use of, and I shall certainly do as well as they." "At that price," said the king, "I won't take it. I myself never use such methods, and I shall never give audience to a sneak. There's something utterly repugnant about such a person. As for female spies, let's not speak of them. Not only are these women prostitutes, but they make the man whom they are preparing to betray the victim of the obscenest sort of play-acting. In the days of my youth, I was something of a solitary, and I got along very easily without society. I've changed a lot, for nowadays I can no longer bear solitude. What I like best is to dine with a pretty woman. And rather than be left at home by myself, I'd go and dine at the osteria. I never read a novel. That kind of reading annoys me. The Augsburger Abendzeitung is the oldest newspaper in Europe. It's a good thing that Amon let it go on existing. But it's a pity that the Fliegende Blätter have disappeared and the Jugend has degenerated. When one cannot keep two enterprises alive at once, I'm in favor of suppressing the newer and keeping the older."
Well, well. There's a lot to talk about in there.
Indeed. Yes.
Well, I had some timeline from the 8th and the 9th, and I'll just give them real quick. The Japanese, they land at Lae, L-A-E, and Salamaua on Huon Bay in New Guinea. They're beginning their move toward Port Moresby, New Guinea, and then Australia. You know, before the show, Ray, I looked up on, I had this globe that I bought because I realized how bad I was with geography. So I bought this globe, and usually I never even look at it anymore, but I was looking around on there. It's better to look on a globe, a real three-dimensional thing, than on a flat map, you know, to get an idea of where things are compared to one another.
Yeah.
And I was, like, amazed at all this, all these islands and archipelagos and everything under Southeast Asia between there and Australia.
That's right.
That stuff there, it's just amazing, huge area.
Yeah.
And so I was looking for this, that, and the other thing, and found them. Anyway, the on the 9th, and that's a tremendous lot of territory that Japan was trying to take over. Oh, my gosh. And I was thinking, you know, how are they going to control all that? But I guess they thought they could, and that's probably why they used somewhat brutal means. But they thought they had to get it all, I guess, if they were going to be in charge, whatever. But I've never studied the Japanese too much. But going on, their troops also entered Rangoon, Burma, which was abandoned by the British 2 days earlier. And it appears that the Japanese are in control of Java, Burma, and New Guinea at this point. All right, going over to the United States, the Secretary of War reorganizes the general headquarters of the United States Army into three major commands: Army Ground Forces, Army Air Forces, and Services of Supply, and then that was later redesignated Army Service Forces. At the same time, the four defense commands and all theaters of operation are subordinated to the War Department General Staff. Well, you know, so that was still called the War Department at that time.
Right.
They hadn't changed it to Defense Department.
Right, and it switched over right at the end of the war.
Uh-huh, since they didn't want to be blamed for the war, right? They weren't war making.
A War Department or Secretary of War connotates aggression, and they wanted to get away from that right quick, so they switched it over to Secretary of Defense, Department of Defense, which is much more palatable to the American public.
Well, it's been that ever since. Okay, that's it.
Okay, well, I was just going to say the Japanese. One particular item of note that you mentioned there, Carolyn, was the occupation of Rangoon in Burma, because they're getting closer and closer to India. And, of course, the British are jumping through hoops trying to do what they can to stop that and slow that advance. And that's going to be part of our topic as we go on to do tonight's work. So,
All right, good.
Okay.
Good. Well,
now, on our section we just covered here was very interesting. He talks about jealousy, the defensive reaction of woman, and but how they take it to such ends. And he used the illustration of this Frau Bruckmann had invited this very pretty lady from Munich Society, and this lady maybe smiled at the Fuhrer and or said something of interest to him, and this Frau Bruckmann and maybe other females there thought that she was out of line. So he, you know, Hitler says she never was invited, she and I were never invited to the same occasion again. And it obviously rankled him a little bit, but he just attributed to, well, that's the, you know, the universe of woman's jealousy.
Well, now, let's remember that this is Hitler's opinion of things and how he sees it, and not necessarily the way others would see it. I thought that first paragraph, what he said there was almost like it came out of a textbook. It was so good, and this is what you generally hear when we talk about our characteristics as particularly male, female, how they developed early back in our evolution when life was so very different, and a woman depended on a man to defend her. She had to have a man to defend her, and it was kind of like they had some little tribes and stuff, but it was kind of like you had to have your own man to look after you, because it was, you couldn't depend on the whole tribe doing it.
Yeah.
So, and this is how this all developed. And when she had got a man, she was going to hang on to him, was going to fight off anybody, any other woman that came along trying to take him away. I could say a whole lot about that, but I don't want to take over the whole show with it. But now, when I thought he said, when he said about the woman who got raucous with emotion when he, where is that?
Under the Frau Bruckmann note, he says, I knew a woman whose voice became raucous with emotion when I spoke in her presence to another woman.
Well, I'm just wondering, you see, if he just spoke in her presence, or if he spent a while talking with her and ignoring the woman he was with, because I've seen that, and I've experienced that also.
Oh, yeah.
And then nothing can make a woman burn, and you feel like a fool, too. If the man you're with, if you meet another, you know, woman, or and he suddenly takes a lot of interest in that woman, even if it's just conversation and talking away with her, and not including you. Now, I don't know. See, we don't know what happened here, but see, I look at it a little differently when I read it. I think of things like that, and you think of other things, so.
Well, you know, that's amazing, because that is a very logical and typical male, I guess. But that part of the, that aspect of it never crossed my mind. It could be that situation.
I've experienced that situation a lot, and I've known other women that have too.
Oh yeah, yeah, it happens certainly.
Including my mother mentioned it with my father a few times.
Uh-huh,
I mean, you know, later on to me that. And he, I remembered seeing him do that. He all of a sudden starts paying a whole lot of attention. He wasn't flirting. He was just paying a whole lot of attention and acting like he didn't have to include, any, you know, my mother in it, or just left her there, you know. I mean, this is how men do this, you know. You wouldn't do that, Ray. You're such a gentleman all the time. I'm
well,
sure
if I did it. It wouldn't be purposefully. It would be just an ignorant neglect.
But, I agree.
You know, also as we went on there, Carolyn, another thing that I thought was fascinating, he said, I mean, if you just take this sentence right here, you would immediately, it would raise the hackles of women particularly that are, I mean, even the slightest bit feminist, where he says intelligence in a woman is not an essential thing. And then when you read the follow-up, and he's talking about, he said, my mother, for example, would actually have cut a pure figure in the society of our cultivated women. But I mean, her world was her husband and her children. They were her entire universe. And then he includes this, but she gave a son to Germany. And there's nothing greater than what his mother did.
Well, see, well, that's what he's thinking. I'm going to put it out this way. He loved his mother. Every man reveres his mother, even if they are angry at their mother and think they hate her or something. But I mean, you know, that's their female model. And so the way his mother was, he certainly would never criticize. And he kind of sees it that that's all a woman needs to do. But that's pretty making a pretty narrow world for women. I don't know. His mother had a pretty horrible life, really. She maybe not horrible. I'm sure she was happy and she loved her children, especially. She lived for her children. But she was very young when she married, and she married an older man. You made do with what you had. That's
exactly right.
You didn't have any right to complain or say anything.
No
options.
You probably
get a little bit of a scolding or maybe even a beating if you started complaining to your husband in a household like that. So, but see, that all influenced Hitler, and he's saying, well, that's good, and we don't need to have women who are talking away. But at the same time, he said, what I like best, he says he doesn't like to be by himself, and what I like best is to dine with a pretty woman. And
yes,
that's true of him always. Well, I don't know when he was real young and poverty-stricken, but that niece of his that everybody likes to say he was, you know, make a lot of stories about, but he liked her company because she was just a normal feminine girl, and he said he liked having her in the same room in the evening when he was reading and so on, and she was just sitting there talking about this and that and things that didn't really matter much. He thought it was just kind of bad, but he enjoyed it, you know. He enjoyed having that kind of company. He enjoyed that kind of woman, female company, just pretty, mm-hmm, attractive, chattering away and so on and telling them about this and that happened and all, and it's clear, it's always been clear that Hitler didn't like women who thought they were going to be talking about serious issues with him. He thought that was really irritating and didn't like it. So, I don't think this is too bad. He's going to go on and say some more things about women as we go on. We'll see. He says she gave a son to Germany. Well, I'm not saying this as a criticism, but somebody could say to him, he didn't give a son to Germany. But he thought I agree with him that he shouldn't have given a son to Germany because he shouldn't have had children. He had his reasons, and I thought they were correct. You know, who could be the son of Adolf Hitler anyway? Yeah, how could you? What a life would you have? How could you live up to that? And particularly the way it ended, I mean, it wouldn't have been any good. So, I mean, it's like, this all works both ways. And too often we don't see it both ways. We just, because that's the battle of the sexes. Last thing I'll say here, Ray, is that in my experience, and it keeps coming up, there's probably no greater struggle amongst different people than between the genders. It never goes away. It stays an issue, even though we have all these other kind of political divisions and so on, and racial divisions. I still think the gender is the most the one that's never going to be corrected, because it's something that is from
natural.
Nature. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
I agree with
but
that.
We do pretty well.
It's the natural state of being, apparently.
Right.
So, hey, you got to make it work the best you can. Okay, we'll move on to the night of the 11th and 12th of March, 1942.
This is the point where Henry Picker is now the note taker.
Ah, okay.
Instead of Heinrich Heim.
The evils of smoking, 3 farthings a day, Berlin, capital of the world. I made acquaintance in Bayreuth of a businessman, a certain Mockel, who invited me to visit him in Nuremberg. There was a notice above his door, "Smokers not admitted." For my part, I have no notice above my door, but smokers aren't admitted. Some time ago, I asked Goring if he really thought it a good idea to be photographed with a pipe in his mouth, and I added, "What would you think of a sculptor who immortalized you with a cigar between your teeth?" It's entirely false to suppose that the soldier wouldn't endure life at the front if he were deprived of tobacco. It's a mistake to be written on the debit side of the high command that from the beginning of the war, it allotted a soldier a daily ration of cigarettes. Of course, there's no question now of going into reverse, but as soon as peace has returned, I shall abolish the ration. We can make better use of our foreign currency than squandering it on imports of poison. I shall start the necessary re-education with the young. I'll tell them, don't follow the example of your elders. I experienced such poverty in Vienna. I spent long months without ever having the smallest hot meal. I lived on milk and dry bread, but I spent 30 kreuzers a day on my cigarettes. I smoked
kreuzers,
between
probably. It's probably kreuzers.
Kreuzers. I smoked between
kreuzers.
25 and 40 of them a day. Well, at that time, a kreuzer meant more to me than 10,000 marks do today. One day I reflected that with 5 kreuzers, I could buy some butter to put on my bread. I threw my cigarettes into the Danube, and since that day, I've never smoked again. I'm convinced that if I had continued to be a smoker, I'd not have held out against the life of incessant worry that has for so long been mine. Perhaps it is to this insignificant detail that the German people owes my having been spared to them. So many men whom I've known have died of excessive use of tobacco. My father, first of all, then Dietrich Eckert, Troost. Soon it'll be your turn, Hoffman. Berlin, as a world capital, can make one think only of ancient Egypt. It can be compared only to Babylon or Rome. In comparison with this capital, what will London stand for, or Paris? That's an interesting little closing note there.
He's talking about tobacco. You know, I found this the most interesting part of all. But I thought this was funny when he said, soon it'll be your turn, Hoffman. really giving a poke at Hoffman there, who's probably a big smoker, obviously. He said on another program we did, he said that Hoffman always likes to make fun of him. He's always, you know, making jokes about him, about Hitler. So he's getting to Hoffman here. Well, is that he said he used to smoke, and I couldn't believe it. Did you know that he smoked at one time?
No, 25 to 40 a day. You know.
Wow, I thought he was always a non-smoker.
Yeah,
because he only got drunk one time when he was a kid, you know, on one of those kid things after they graduated, and he got so sick, and we read about that he said
right,
he'd never drink again. But I never thought he smoked, and this is the only place I've ever seen that he said he did. And that was terrible, because if he said these crates, I wonder how much a Kreutzer is worth. Is it like a penny or something? And he said with 5 Kreutzers, he could buy butter, and he spent, what do you say? I can't find my place yet. 35 to 40 of them a day for his cigarettes. Wow, that's really, and he had nothing to eat. I mean, he's saying, I lived on dry bread and milk. I had nothing to eat, but yet I spent all that money on cigarettes. That doesn't even make sense to me. Sounds really stupid. But I don't know how long he was smoking like that, but he probably got in with those working class people in Vienna, and they were all smoking, so he probably, you know, they offered him some.
Just,
he probably took up smoking just to be like
to
everybody
do
else.
A habit.
Yeah, and but at least he woke up to that and stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a way to waste a lot of money while you're starving.
Absolutely.
Very interesting, I must say.
And you know, that's interesting that you bring up the fact that we didn't know that he was a smoker. And jumping in to this next section here, I want our listeners to think about this too. If someone had come up to me and asked me, what was Adolf Hitler's opinion of gambling? I would have had to guess at it, but I had my conclusions. And reading this section here, I was very, very surprised. I would have been wrong and off base. And yet he logically explains his feelings about it. So that's coming up. I thought
yeah,
that was going to be...
Yeah, well, you're right. No, I'm glad you said that. You would have thought differently. Continuing with this just a little bit, Hitler's known for his anti-smoking campaigns and so on. And the
yes.
National Socialism for going all out and then doing his discovering that smoking was related to cancer and he went all out for that. That's why we didn't know that he ever smoked. But Hitler's like someone who, when he gets, he sees what is the truth. And I was going to say he sees what he thinks is the truth, but actually he's absolutely right, and it is. And then he wants to, he does try to proselytize or get other people to do the same thing. So he was always telling these all his associates that they should quit smoking and so on. And I don't know if they smoked during these meal times when after meal. I think they did.
I do,
but
too.
Maybe not too much. They probably, if they wanted to smoke more, they went out, they left the table and went outdoors or somewhere. Outside the dining room.
That's probably true, Carolyn, because remember he said he knew a fellow that had a sign above his door, no smoking.
Right.
And he said, I felt the same way. I just wouldn't have the sign above my door. So
yeah, I think in meetings with the generals and so on, he said that he didn't allow them to smoke. So they'd all be outside the door, having their smokes and so on. That was, I think he just couldn't tolerate it, when they all smoked, practically. And he did the same with, with his diet, with vegetarianism.
Oh, yes.
He was always making fun of these people. He didn't stop them, but he'd say, oh, how can you eat that dead stuff? And he'd start talking about things about slaughterhouses and so on.
Yeah.
While they were eating their meat. And they didn't let it bother them, though, is what I understand. They just, let him go. But he thought he was right, and he was trying to. I think that comes partly from a helpful person who wants to help other people see the light, as he's seen. I really don't think it's just from a bossy kind of thing, because he didn't really boss anybody around in the
right.
Way. Yeah. So, it's interesting.
Right. And this next section jumps 12 days. We were on 11th and 12th of March, and this next entry is the 24th of March, 1942, at dinner.
Well, let's see if there's anything important in the timeline. On the 12th, American troops begin to land in Noumea, New Caledonia. And I looked that up, too, on my globe, finally found it. It will become an important staging base for the eventual invasion of Guadalcanal. That's over to the, I don't know if you still call it east or if it becomes west, but the east of, what I would think of is the east of Australia and a little above New Zealand in that little protected area there. And the, but on the 13th, the RAF launches an air raid against Essen, Germany. That was one of the early and very of those terrible air raids that shocked the German
firebombing.
How bad they were. And on the 14th, the Japanese do land troops in the Solomon Islands, and underscoring Australia's dangerous situation, an airfield is built on Guadalcanal. And the Japanese are now threatening American forces around Manila Bay, and the retreat to Corregidor begins. No wonder they weren't having any. So much was going on. On the 17th, the U.S. General Douglas MacArthur arrived in Australia after leaving the Philippines, and the United Kingdom institutes rationing of electricity, coal, and gas. The clothing ration is decreased as well. Well, the Allies were really at a... the underdog at this point, in a sense.
Yeah, they were rocked back on their heels pretty good.
Yeah. Right. Well, gosh, there's even more. Then on the 20th, Operation Outward begins, which I just read about, which was, those big balloons. The British were going to try to attack Germany with these barrage balloons. I thought barrage balloons were to keep the airplanes get the enemy airplanes getting caught up in them. But I guess there were some that were sent over. I guess the Japanese had done it, but they had better balloons. And they had stuff in them. I don't know. They were supposed to interfere with the electrical lines and various things and maybe cut out the electricity and just cause a lot of trouble, but they didn't work all that well. On the 22nd, a fractured convoy reached Malta after heavy losses to the Luftwaffe and an Italian sea force. What is that? Whose convoy? Continued heavy bombing attacks on the island with slight opposition from overtaxed RAF air forces, it says. And on the 25th, the RAF sends bomber raids against targets in France and Germany. Mm-hmm. Well, we know about those.
Right.
That's all that I have up to the 25th.
Okay, well, I want to add one note on those Japanese balloons.
Mm-hmm.
You're right on what they were. Some of them were to do, but many, many more of them were. They contained, underneath that balloon, they contained incendiaries. And being as the West Coast was very, very forested and green and all, it was like they had hoped to ignite many, many forest fires.
The Japanese did?
Yeah. I mean, that was part of their balloon program, not just to send balloons that would disrupt electronic communications or with a slight explosive in them.
Those were the British ones.
Yeah. But the they sent some of the balloons on the West Coast that actually landed and all, but were very futile. It didn't amount to much at all, but they did try to ignite forest fires. So,
wow.
Anyway.
Huh.
Okay, 24th of March, 1942, at dinner. Information at the enemy's disposal, better use of manpower in the Wehrmacht, protection of private property, limits of private ownership, the rights of the state, the ethics of lotteries and gambling, industrial power monopolies, capitalist interests. In spite of their inclination to criticize all we do, the democracies miss no opportunity of imitating us when we take measures designed to simplify our organization. That's why it will be better in future to give no press publicity to our innovations in this field, for by doing so, we are giving useful information to the enemy nations and enabling them to profit from our own experiences. Even in dealing with facts of this nature, silence is nowadays obligatory. And
well,
right here
I'm
in the
break
text,
in the, oh, you go ahead. You want to say that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Carolyn, that right here the text becomes italicized, and it's the interpreter, the translator here, that adds this note himself.
Okay, let me say something about what you just read.
I think that
is just fantastic, and I agree with that so much that that Germany has always given too much away, and they should stop giving so much away, and that they do all these innovations, and then they give this information. Of course, in this case, it was wartime and it was going to the enemy nations. But he said that they're saying you have to be silent. But Germans weren't very good at silence, and they weren't that good. They weren't even that good at espionage, even though they had some very good people and accomplished a lot of good things. But they weren't as good as their enemies were. And part of the silence thing is that they talked too darn much, and it didn't take it all, I guess, seriously enough or something. Couldn't see people as enemies like they should see them as enemies.
Well, that's it.
Okay.
That's it. I was going to say I might be off base here, but I've always felt that German sense of, sharing things that they shouldn't have shared came out of being naive, but more so out of not having a mean streak a sneaky streak and things like this, and just a more trusting person. And
right.
They never thought like reorganizing and simplifying organizations and things like this, changing procedures to make their whole organization more efficient. I don't think they ever thought of it as something that would slip to the Americans or to the British and work to their detriment. They just they didn't have that mindset that would have probably have served them well if they did have it.
Yeah, in these situations, it would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So this that I'm reading right now is put in there by the translator. As regards the use of manpower, General Jodl observed that there had been a clear improvement in the Wehrmacht as compared with the Army of the First World War, in which a fisherman was transformed into an Alpine light infantryman and a butcher into an office clerk under the pretext of training the soldier. Nowadays, on the other hand, every effort was taken to make the best use of each man's talents to the greatest benefit of the community. Hitler interrupted.
Is this part in italic, too, what Hitler is saying?
No.
Okay, so
now we're back to Hitler.
So he didn't want to add Jodl's words directly. He gave them himself, I see.
Yeah. And Hitler says, we mustn't look at things from the narrow standpoint of the Wehrmacht, but from the standpoint of the nation as a whole. I'll take the case of a reserve officer. I suppose that in civil life he holds an important post, even from the standpoint of the conduct of the war. Very naturally, this man will be tempted to leave his job and offer his services to the army, either from patriotism or for fear of being regarded as a draft dodger. Thus, the Wehrmacht will take the man and put him in an office, thus swelling an already plethoric administration, and the man will be lost to the activity in which he'd have been more useful to us. Wouldn't it be simpler to put a uniform on his back and mobilize him at his job? I absolutely insist on protecting private property. It is natural and salutary that the individual should be inspired by the wish to devote a part of the income from his work to building up and expanding a family estate. Suppose the estate consists of a factory. I regard it as axiomatic in the ordinary way that this factory will be better run by one of the members of the family than it would be by a state functionary, providing, of course, that the family remains healthy. In this sense, we must encourage private initiative. On the other hand, I'm distinctly opposed to property in the form of anonymous participation in societies of shareholders. This sort of shareholder produces no other effort but that of investing his money, and thus he becomes the chief beneficiary of other people's effort. The worker's zest for their job, the ideas of an engineer of genius, the skill of an experienced administrator. It's enough for this capitalist to entrust his money to a few well-run firms, and he's betting on a certainty. The dividends he draws are so high that they can compensate for any loss that one of these firms might perhaps cause him. I have therefore always been opposed to incomes that are purely speculative and entail no effort on the part of those who live on them. Such gains belong by right to the nation, which alone can draw a legitimate profit from them. In this way, at least, those who create these profits, the engineers and the workers, are entitled to be the beneficiaries. In my view, joint stock companies should pass in their entirety under the control of the state. There's nothing to prevent the latter from replacing these shares that bring in a variable interest by debentures which it guarantees and which produce a fixed interest in a manner useful to private people who wish to invest their savings. I see no better method of suppressing the immoral form of income based only on speculation, of which England today provides the most perfect example. This attitude toward stocks and shares entails, by way of compensation on our part, the obligation to maintain the value of money, no matter what happens, and prevent any boom in products of prime necessity. A man who, within the framework of such an organization, consented to pay 1,000 marks for a Persian rug that's worth only 800, would prove that he's an imbecile, but there's no way of stopping him. In the same way, one can't stop a gambler from losing his money at gambling or from taking his own life when he's lost his money. One might relevantly wonder whether the state, which is the main beneficiary of gambling, should not make itself responsible for the cost of the suicide's funeral. We should bear in mind, in fact, that more than half of the profits of gambling, whether lotteries or games of chance played in the casinos, goes into the coffers of the state. In addition to the material profit the state derives from them, I think I can say that from a purely philosophic point of view, lotteries have their good side. Tangible realities are not enough to ensure men's happiness. It's not a bad idea to keep alive in them the taste for illusions, and most of them live on hopes to which a great extent cannot become reality. It seems to me, therefore, that the best part of a lottery is not the list immediately proclaiming the winners. On the contrary, the results should be dragged out for a year if possible, a year in which the gambler has leisure to nourish his illusions and forge his dreams of happiness. The Austrian state knew about this and used the system very intelligently. This explains why, even in the most difficult times, there were always so many happy people in that country. And instead of going on right here, I want to stop a little bit, Carolyn, because this is when he's talking about different kinds of gambling, the state lottery and things like this. And, of course, he's just told us that the real benefit of the lottery doesn't come in those few who win, but it comes in the form of giving illusion and hope to those people, like even today. Hey, man, I'd love to win that lottery. I'm going to go down and put a couple of dollars on the ticket tonight. And the optimism or the hope that it gives them, something to look forward to. And Hitler says that's the best thing of this lottery right there, is it gives nourishment to illusions and forges dreams of happiness. And he said the Austrian state knew about that, and that's why their lottery was so successful. I was just going to say, that one particular sentence that Hitler says, tangible realities are not enough to ensure men's happiness. They need something to dream about, something to hope for, a long shot, put a little money down and maybe you'll hit the big one, or just anything like that. So, and this is what surprises me, and that's why I said at the start of this section that had someone asked me about how Hitler felt about gambling, I wouldn't have known. I'd have had to guess, but I would have thought, well, he would be morally opposed to it or against it on moral grounds. But as we see here, he's starting to explain there's a good side to it, and it provides something positive.
Well, I think he is also implying or saying that the tangible thing soon loses, is not as great as you thought it would be when you're hoping to get it. And that pretty much is true on everything. Hoping for something that you don't have or that you have these illusions about it, how much happiness it's going to bring you, whether it's a woman or a job or this or that. There's always drawbacks to everything. So he says the best part is thinking about it. But once you get something, even when it comes to money, it soon you realize it doesn't bring you all that happiness that you put into it. So it might be a little bit. I don't know. I don't want to say childish, unsophisticated. But right. He realized that most people were, and that's this is where they lived. And so we can see from the things people do where they put their money that they need these kind of hopes, and they live on them. So another interesting part of this is that when he's talking about how the income. He's against capitalism for sure, and he's against people having capital and living off money that they just invest in certain ways, which there's no
provided no labor to get.
Yeah, and he thinks that all that kind of money should go to the state. So that's great under him and his kind of state, I think, although he had all that money to use for things that not everybody agreed with. But still, but you need a small, unified nation and good leadership for that to work.
That's right.
And then I would agree with it. And that's really, I think, you know, I think to myself, why I'm a nationalist, and my nationalism is thinking of being a part of a German nation. And, you know, it really is. And not even just a white nation, with all kinds of every kind of white person, but a particular kind of group of people that you feel can care about one another, have a lot of similarities, and then you can work things out for what's best for yourself. And you should, I think, use it for yourself and not think you need to take care of other people or outsiders or whatever, which is something I was thinking about today, but I don't know if it's about tonight's show.
Yeah.
So there you go. What he's saying is good for Germany at the time that he's there as the Führer, but it's not necessarily good to have the state take over everything with anybody and everybody.
Right.
You know, we've seen it work out very badly. So, and you have to have people who are motivated to continue to invent. There has to be a reason for people to work hard at things, and money is usually considered the best motivator for people.
Mm-hmm.
But in Germany at that time, National Socialism was able to inspire people for the nation, and Germany had had such a hard time, and so most people did have this patriotism and love for the country and the people, wanting to make everything better. So that's what you have to have, though, in order for that kind of thing to work, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
And now he goes on saying about the origin of the lottery. He says, the origin of the lottery goes back doubtless to the beginning of the 18th century, when an astute minister wondered why the profits of gambling should not go into the state's coffers instead of going to swell private purses. When the state uses the money it wins, thus for some good purpose, to build hospitals, for example, the affair takes on a coloring of idealism. Gambling, first of all, sustains the gambler's hopes. When chance has given its verdict, and if the gambler is thereafter comparable to a man who has made an unlucky bet, he still has a consolation, that of having contributed to a good work. I studied the question of gambling as regards Wiesbaden with Gauleiter Wagner. What gives the lottery its pleasant character is not to be found, unfortunately, in roulette and other games of chance played in the casinos. But if we'd withdrawn the authorization for gambling at Wiesbaden, that would have done a considerable wrong to that thermal resort without any profit to the inveterate gamblers, whom this measure would obviously not have amended. They'd simply have gone and gambled somewhere else on the other side of the frontier, to the profit, that's to say, of the French. Speaking of that, I inquired how much foreign currency the gambling at Wiesbaden might bring us in, and I told myself that even 100,000 marks in foreign money, it's not much when one has it, is quite a sum when one is poor. I drew the conclusion from all this that gamblers can be useful to the state by losing their money, and especially foreign gamblers when they lose in their own currency. Experience proved that in retaining gambling in a few casinos, we made a sound calculation. In addition to the foreign currencies we thus collected, it enabled us to retain resorts like Wiesbaden for the German community. It goes without saying that the institution of gambling, which produces great profits simply because it's a monopoly and because it entails no payment of labor in exchange, must go to enrich the state and not private people.
Ray, you know, now this shows that Hitler does have a method to his madness about gambling.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That Germany was very short on foreign currency. Foreign currency was always a problem, at least, all through the 30s they were concerned about it, you know, trying to get more of it and so on. So as a way to do it, this gambling worked well, so therefore you're more likely to find reasons why it's okay to do it and why it's good, as long as the state is running it and the state is using it for necessary purposes for the whole nation, as they saw it. They were the state, so basically the whole question, I really think that his acceptance of gambling is because He saw that people wanted to do it, that, and they do. My gosh, they
yes.
do.
Yes.
And that they wanted, if they had any money, you know, to spend, they wanted, a lot of people love to go and spend it at casinos and so on. I wouldn't, but, and then he knows that if they didn't do it, somebody else would, and people would go there. Well, those were the arguments that were used here in the United States for these states to take on gambling themselves, because they said, well, if we don't do it, the people are going to, some other state's going to get all the money because they go over here and do it. And so it's funny how that is, how that was picked up. When did this come up, in the 70s or 80s or something in the United States, maybe even in the 90s. And this was already already been decided on by Hitler in the 30s and 40s. So,
yeah. And you know, one other point right here after that last paragraph to me was this is why laws, state or federal laws against gambling, are so rigidly enforced. And you know, like, hey, every state has people that like to bet on football games or baseball, horse races, whatever, among themselves. And the state cracks down on that vociferously. And it's not a moral issue at all. The reason why they're cracking down on it, because the state is not getting its cut.
Right.
And, you know, so all this stuff about, oh, gambling's evil and whatever, that's just wind dressing. It has nothing to do with the morality of the issue. It's that they don't like people betting with some private little bookie on some football games because they don't get a cut of the action. So that's
right.
What that's about.
Right. So, well, I wonder how much gambling must be big money makers.
It is.
There's so interest in it, in the powers that be and so on. So it must be because there's just huge money in it.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Well, they don't get my money.
But they get it some mine in some time. Now, right here in the text, Carolyn, there's another. This is italicized, meaning that the translator actually put this in there. It's only a sentence. Borman commented that this principle should be equally true as regards industrial power production. Hitler went on, so now he goes back to what Hitler's saying. Mm-hmm. It's obvious that the power monopoly must be vested in the state. That does not exclude the participation of private capital. The state would offer its securities for investment by the public, which would thus be interested in the exploitation of the monopoly, or rather in the favorable progress of state business. The fact is that when state affairs are not prospering, the holders of certificates can put a cross through their unearned incomes, for the various affairs in which the state is interested cannot be dissociated. The advantage of our formula would be to enable everyone to feel closely linked with state affairs. Today, unfortunately, most people are not clear-sighted enough to realize the closeness of this link. What is true of the power industry is equally true of all the essential primary materials. That is to say, it applies also to petroleum, coal, steel, and water power. Capitalist interest will have to be excluded from this sort of business. We do not, of course, contemplate preventing a private person from using the energy of the tiny stream that powers his small works. Here's a typical fact, and one that proves the dishonesty of the commercial procedures to which the joint stock companies resort. It's the case of the former Bavarian minister Schweyer, who owed his ministerial appointment only to his remarkable imbecility, and on that everyone was unanimous. He received from Bavaria Electricity, of which he was chairman, a yearly pension of 38,000 marks. Despite all the legal obstacles, I managed to have this pension suppressed, since this man had not supplied any services to an equivalent value. Far from it. The present law allows the Chancellor of the Reich a pension of 34,000 marks, and this comparison enables one to realize the scandalous enormity of privileges like Schweyer's. The problem of monopolies handed over to capitalist interest interested me even in my boyhood. I'd been struck by the example of the Danube Shipping Company, which received an annual subsidy of $4 million, a quarter of which was at once shared out amongst its 12 directors. Each of the big parties was represented in this august college by at least two of its members, each of them pocketing about 80 million kronen yearly. One may feel sure that these mandarins saw to it that the comrades voted punctually for the renewal of the subsidy. But the socialists were acquiring more and more importance, and it happened that none of their lot was on the board. That's why the scandal broke. The company was attacked in the parliament and in the press. Threatened with being deprived of the subsidy, it replied by abolishing the passenger service. And since the politicians on the board had already taken care that no railway should be built along the Danube, the riverside populations were the chief victims of these arbitrary measures. A solution of the conflict was found quite rapidly, and you can imagine which. Quite simply, the number of members of the board was increased to 14, and the two new seats were offered to two well-known socialists who hastened to accept them. What makes England
so fragile?
Well,
now, what do you make of this last paragraph here?
I think it's just is he's describing of how capitalist corruption is such a detriment and crooked and is a detriment to the people. If you allow this privateering to go that far.
Yeah, because they're enriching themselves. And
yes.
And we know how they do that here. And we know it's going on all over the world. It's been for a long, long time. I mean, it's incredible enriching of yourselves. And, well, it shows that Hitler and his allies there, the National Socialists, they were, here's the socialist part, you know? I mean, they were socialist in that. They weren't going to allow these people. So they weren't, they liked free enterprise and the fact of people starting up things and coming up with things. But when it came to basic services and power and a lot of these other things, they wanted the state to run it, and they wanted the state, which they always saw as all the people. You know, it wasn't the state.
Yes. Yes.
People in the state pocketing the money and getting rich, but it belonged to the people of the nation, and it should be overseen, supposedly, honestly and fairly, by the state, and that this was, they were, so people who don't like this, and a lot of people don't, you know, and
right.
People who want everything to be private enterprise, you might say, would find a lot of fault with the National Socialism. And there,
sure.
But there again, I think that it has to be, again, in a small, homogeneous nation.
Agreed.
For it
Agreed.
To work. You know, it just doesn't,
yes.
You can't do this and have the state ownership with some large conglomerate like the United States government.
Yeah, and also the implication here, and it was alluded to earlier, that if you have this totally capitalist operated, whether it's a power companies, transportation, whatever, it's always subject to financial manipulations to, let's say, for the power company that's being run by these private speculators with investments in coal and oil and power generating. And all of a sudden they can come up and say, oh, well, it's been a bad year for the coal mines, so we're sorry, people, but we're going to have to up your monthly charge for the electric service. We're going to have to double it. So this, with the state owning this and looking out for the state, which is the people, it takes mm-hmm. that garbage out of it too.
Right.
And I think that's very much a part of National Socialism, and that's also why National Socialism was so hated by the exploiters, the capitalists, the communists, the Jews. They jumped all over that because that sort of existence of hook and crook and shysterism is part of their makeup.
Yeah, but you know, nationalization and so on can also bring about a lowering of the you know, of the quality of the services and so on. It can make the people, you know, lazy, and you know, they don't really have to earn a living because it's all, you know, they just work there, and nobody's owning it, and there's no owner that's pushing for, and stockholders and so on is pushing for. So there's a good side and a bad side always, because you if you have stockholders pushing for more profit, you can screw your consumers, but
yeah,
you can also insist that you have better management and so on, and that they're really doing their job. But then the management gets all the big salaries. So it's again, you have to have people in charge who really care about the whole nation and want to make it into
That's
something.
That's it. You hit
wonderful.
The nail on the head a while ago,
yeah,
when you said you have to have a
yeah
unified group of people who share
yeah
a common sense of survival and responsibility to each other, and they look out for the welfare of the state as a whole.
So then that comes first, and then the economic system you use comes after that. Why
That's
why
it.
Argue about economic systems and which one is better if you don't have a, well, you have, first you have to have the right kind of a people. You have to have the right kind of a nation,
That's
a
it
country. And then you decide your economic system that's going to work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Very yes, good. Thanks. What makes England so fragile is that her whole economic system is founded on similar practices. From the moment of our seizure of power, having my own set of ideas on the subject, I took the precaution of forbidding every director of a company to be a member of the Reichstag. Since men who have interest in a private company cannot be objective on a great number of questions, I likewise forbade office holders in the party to take part in business of a capitalist complexion. The same prohibition applies, by the way, to all servants of the state. I therefore cannot allow an official, whether he belongs to the army or to the civil administration, to invest his savings in industry except in companies controlled by the state. And all I see there is he's avoiding a conflict of interest and corruption by all we got to do is look at what we got today, and it's rotten to the core of it. And what he's doing right there is addressing that very problem. This conflict of interest, or you know, if you're a member of the government and you own quite a lot of stock or whatever in some company, then your actions in the government regarding any legislation is not going to be for the good of the people necessarily. It's going to be for what lines your own pocket, and that little sense of greed. And I think that's what he's addressing there.
Well, I think that's why he always thought that the National Socialist Party would prevent any of this bad side of this stuff happening. And
exactly,
that as long as they trained these party, they had these party schools and so on and all kinds of training. And then, of course, the SS was to be trained as the totally incorruptible, you know, service to the nation of the best people and so on. And he believed in this, and
mm-hmm
Himmler believed in it. That's what they were trying to do, and they knew, see, they knew that they had to have something like this to go on into the future, or it would deteriorate into everybody grabbing stuff for themselves.
Right.
And whether this could have succeeded without Hitler there, and then even later without him, you know, whether there would be people, they trusted that there would be. They had to. You have to believe that there's more sons and, you know, coming up in your country who are, can do what, you know, can carry on properly. So, but we never got to see whether that would work out or
right
not.
Right.
All right.
That's right.
Well, you know, you're going to talk about Stanford Cripps, and I've got a little short thing that I had
Good
done up on this man at a previous time, and I'd like to read it. But you go ahead. Well, maybe I'll just start out with it because so people know a little bit more about this Stanford Cripps, because he talks
sure
about him quite a bit, not just in the beginning, but a little
yes
further on. And this is from Giesler Einanderer, Hitler, but I don't think it's from there. It's just, no, it's from, I looked, it's from somewhere else, but he was talking, Stanford Cripps came up in Giesler's book. But it says, Sir Stafford Cripps, an ardent Marxist, made the Time cover on November 10, 1946. Now, get that, he was an ardent Marxist.
Yes.
In spite of being expelled from his own Labor Party in early 1939 for organizing a popular front of liberals, laborites, and communists to try to bring down the Chamberlain government, he offered his services to that government at the outbreak of the war. In spite of the fact that he was trying to bring it down, once war broke out, you know, it's like, well, we got all pulled together now, so I'm here to serve you in whatever way, he says to Chamberlain. Well, Chamberlain ignored him, but the next thing Britain knew, Cripps was on a trip around the world calling on Molotov in Russia, Nehru, and Roosevelt. Some speculated he was on a secret mission for the Chamberlain government, the objective of which was to get Stalin to sign a mutual defense pact with Britain. Others believed it was Churchill, who later appointed Cripps to be his ambassador to Moscow, who arranged the trip. But was this his real mission, or was it to drag out talks and negotiations with Britain, drag it out with Russia, in the hopes that either Hitler or Stalin would start their war and bleed each other to the advantage of Great Britain? On this issue, historians are still divided and so on. Well, I don't think I need to read any more of that. So that just gives a background on this man.
Okay, and I'd like to add to that a little bit about that guy. He, and I think it's the part that we'll be discussing here, was on a mission to India because India's governing Congress, of course, under the British, was extremely upset that England had declared India a belligerent country against the Axis powers, without consulting the Indians to see if they wanted to fight in this. And the British did that because of the Japanese advancement into Burma, Rangoon, and they said, okay, we got to have a buddy here fighting with us. We can have a couple of million men, India, fighting for us if we'll just go ahead and declare war for India. And this upset India greatly, and there was a lot of internal dissension against that that people didn't want to be a part of the war, and to particularly fight for the British, who many Indians saw as their oppressors. And so it was Cripps' job to go over there and try to get the Indian people to agree to come along with the Brits. And he failed in getting a unified India to fight for England. That was the mission that he was on. And it was thanks to the efforts of a patriot, Indian patriot like Chandra Bose, the very nationalist, that, you know, actually fought against the British and people who were following him. So this is Cripps. And the dateline, 27th March 1942, midday, influence of Stafford Cripps, British conservatives and German middle classes, Labor Party needs a Cromwell, unrest in India, Jewish influence on German art, painting in Germany, women in politics, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, Lola Montez. One thing is indisputable. In Stafford Cripps, and as a counterpart to Churchill, England has found a statesman whose influence is not negligible. It's a symptom, to say the least, that the English trade unions have been able recently to draw up a program for the nationalization of the land, to propose a law on the ownership of buildings and another on an organic reform of industry and transport. All that must have a repercussion on the country's internal situation. We have always found it difficult to believe that such reforms can be put through from one day to the next, and that reasonable Englishmen should think this possible. Let's not forget that it took the Russians more than 10 years to carry the experiment through to the end. There is doubtless a state of crisis in England, and we must reckon with it. The economy is deficient. The organization of the civil service is deplorable. The English middle class has to submit to dietary restrictions, and there are military setbacks. In the long run, all that ends by having an effect on a nation's morale. Let us always take care not to exaggerate the importance of these signs. If the king has no real influence on the orientation of English politics, that doesn't prevent him from being an important political factor, insofar as the army retains its strength and integrity. For the British Army is monarchist in spirit, and is, so to speak, entirely recruited amongst the aristocracy and the conservative world. Now, these people are not at present showing any inclination to make the slightest concessions to the people. It's enough to glance through an English illustrated periodical to be convinced of that. One sees only photos of men belonging to the aristocracy, and two-thirds of them are photographed in uniform. One cannot compare the English conservatives to the old German bourgeoisie that formed the nationalist parties before 1933. The English conservatives identify themselves with the empire. They represent traditions and a solidly established form of society, and it's difficult to see them capitulating to the people like the French aristocracy in 1789. Quite the contrary, they're striving by means of a gigantic organization to propagate their own ideas amongst the people, trying to fill it with the patriotic fanaticism that inspires its airmen and sailors. To establish himself against the conservatives, it would take a Cromwell at the head of the Labor Party, for the conservatives will not yield without a fight. Now, although Cripps, who has Stalin's confidence, has succeeded in sowing socialist ideas in England, I don't think he carries enough guns for this role. From my point of view, a red, and therefore fallen, England would be much less favorable than an England of conservatives. In fact, a socialist England, and therefore an England tainted with Sovietism, would be a permanent danger in the European space, for she would founder in such poverty that the territory of the British Isles would prove too small for 30 million inhabitants to be able to keep alive there. I hope, therefore, that Cripps will be sunk by the fiasco of his mission to India, the most difficult mission with which an Englishman can now be charged. If he isn't, it would become more and more difficult to avoid civil war on British soil. But the mobilization of the masses on which the Labor Party's propaganda is working, and which would be the result of the execution of the trade union's new program, should be regarded as a very serious threat. Between Churchill and Cripps, I have no hesitation in choosing. I prefer 100 times the undisciplined swine who's drunk 8 hours of every 24 to the Puritan, a man who spends extravagantly, an elderly man who drinks and smokes without moderation, is obviously less to be feared than the drawing-room Bolshevist who leads the life of an ascetic. From Churchill, one may finally expect that in a moment of lucidity, it's not impossible, he'll realize that the empire is going inescapably to its ruin if the war lasts another 2 or 3 years. Cripps, a man without roots, a demagogue, and a liar, would pursue his sick fancies, although the empire were to crack at every corner. Moreover, this theoretician, devoid of humanity, lacks contact with the mass that's grouped behind the Labor Party, and he'll never succeed in understanding the problems that occupy the minds of the lower classes. To judge Cripps accurately and to appreciate the dangers he represents, one must not forget that the Tories have always been the props of the empire, and that Cripps' gaining control would mean the end of the empire. With his hypocritical social programs, he'd be sure to dig a pit between the mother country and the dominions, especially the Catholic Canadians, Australia, and South Africa. One must therefore eagerly hope for the failure of his mission to India. It is questionable, by the way, whether Cripps will get any hearing from the Indian people. The Indian world has already been so disturbed by the presence of the Japanese on its frontiers and by the fall of Singapore that the man of compromise, Nehru, has been eclipsed by Bose. If today Cripps endeavors, with the help of blackmail or begging, to induce the Indians to resist the Japanese, I doubt whether Nehru, however much he would like to, would be able to help him effectively. Nehru's fate will be like that of the socialists in 1918, who were swept away by the masses. I'm thinking of Ebert, who had come to the meeting in the Treptow Park with the intention of opposing the munition strike. He began by making a few concessions to the crowd in the hope of getting himself heard, but he was quickly overcome by the crowd's enthusiasm, with the result that he himself had to preach the very strike he had intended to torpedo. In an affair of this nature, every negotiator, every speaker runs the same danger. I've experienced it myself at Weimar in 1926, and I've seen with what precautions and how artfully one must proceed when one intends to tell the public the opposite of what it expects from you. As for the Indian masses, in any case, one thing is certain, that it doesn't want to have anything more to do with the English. I've often had occasion during recent years to...
Okay, so now we're going to talk about art a little bit here. Do you want to comment on anything about the, what we just read? It's pretty clear cut.
I think let that go.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
We'll finish up then with the art. I like this part.
Yeah. I've often had occasion during recent years to immerse myself in collections of the review Die Kunst.
Kunst.
It's striking to observe that in 1910, our artistic level was still extraordinarily high. Since that time, alas, our decadence has merely become accentuated. In the field of painting, for example, it's enough to recall the lamentable daubs that people have tried to foist in the name of art on the German people. This was quite especially the case during the Weimar Republic, and that clearly demonstrated the disastrous influence of the Jews in matters of art. The cream of the jest was the incredible impudence with which the Jew set about it. With the help of phony art critics, and with one Jew bidding against another, they finally suggested to the people, which naturally believes everything that's printed, a conception of art according to which the worst rubbish in painting became the expression of the height of artistic accomplishment. The 10,000 of the elite themselves, despite their pretensions on the intellectual level, let themselves be diddled and swallowed all the humbug. The culminating hoax, and we now have proof of it, thanks to the seizure of Jewish property, is that, with the money they fraudulently acquired by selling trash, the Jews were able to buy, at wretched prices, the works of value they had so cleverly depreciated. Every time an inventory catches my eye of a requisition carried out on an important Jew, I see that genuine artistic treasures are listed there. It's a blessing of Providence that National Socialism, by seizing power in 1933, was able to put an end to this imposture. When I visit an exhibition, I never fail to have all the daubs pitilessly withdrawn from it. It will be admitted that whoever visits the House of German Art today will not find any work there that isn't worthy of its place. Everything that hasn't an undeniable value has been sieved out. I never hesitated, even when it was a question of works by painters given prizes by the Academy of Prussia, to ban these works from the House of German Art whenever they were worthless. It's a pity that the Academy is not up to its task, and that its members played amongst themselves the game of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. The latest victim was our Minister of Religious Affairs, who knows as much about art as a hippopotamus. He fell into the most obvious traps and gave official rewards to genuine ordure. The Jews had succeeded in lulling him to sleep by using on him the same methods as had already enabled him to trick the whole German people. On the subject of these daubs, people assert that it isn't easy to understand them, and that to penetrate their depth and significance, one must be able to immerse oneself entirely in the image represented, and other idiocies from the same mill. In the years 1905-1906, when I entered the Vienna Academy, these hollow phrases were already being used to give publicity to innumerable daubs under the pretext of artistic experiment. In a general way, the academies have nothing to tell me that's worth listening to. In fact, the professors who are active there are either failures or else artists of talent, but who cannot devote more than 2 hours a day to their teaching, or else weary old men who therefore have nothing more to give. Genuine artists develop only by contact with other artists. Like the old masters, they began by working in a studio. Let's remember that men like Rembrandt, Rubens, and others hired assistants to help them complete all their commissions. Amongst these assistants, only those reached the rank of apprentice who displayed the necessary gifts as regards technique and adroitness, and of whom it could be supposed that they would, in their turn, be capable of producing works of value. It's ridiculous to claim, as it's claimed in the academies, that right from the start, the artist of genius can do what he likes. Such a man must begin, like everyone else, by learning, and it's only by working without relaxation that he succeeds in achieving what he wants. If he doesn't know the art of mixing colors to perfection, if he cannot set a background, if anatomy still has secrets for him, it's certain he won't go very far. I can imagine the number of sketches it took an artist as gifted as Menzel before he set himself to paint the flute concert at Sanssouci. It would be good if artists today, like those of olden days, had the training afforded by the master's studios and could thus steep themselves in the great pictorial traditions. If, when we look at the pictures of Rembrandt and Rubens, for example, it is often difficult to make out what the master has painted himself and what is his pupil's share, that's due to the fact that gradually the disciples themselves became masters. What a disaster it was the day when the state began to interfere with the training of painters. As far as Germany is concerned, I believe that two academies would suffice, in Dusseldorf and Munich, or perhaps three in all if we add Vienna to the list. Obviously, there's no question for the moment of abolishing any of our academies, but that doesn't prevent one from regretting that the tradition of the studios has been lost. If after the war I can realize my great building program, and I intend to devote thousands of millions to it, only genuine artists will be called on to collaborate. The others may wait until doomsday, even if they're equipped with the most brilliant recommendations. Numerous examples taken from history prove that woman, however intelligent she may be, is not capable of dissociating reason from feeling in matters of a political nature. And the formidable thing in this field is the hatred of which women are capable. I've been told that after the occupation of the province of Shanghai, the Japanese offered Chiang Kai-shek's government to withdraw their troops from Chinese territory on condition A, of being able to maintain a garrison in Shanghai's international concession, B, of obtaining advantageous terms on the conclusion of a trade treaty. It seems that all the generals approved of this proposal and encouraged Chiang Kai-shek to accept it. But when Madame Chiang Kai-shek had spoken, urged on by her measureless hatred of Japan, the majority of the generals reversed their decisions, and thus it was that Japan's offer, although a very generous one, was rejected. One might speak likewise of the influence of Lola Montez over Ludwig I of Bavaria. The latter was by nature a reasonable and understanding king, but that woman completely drove him from his course. There we go.
Well, we're going over a little bit on this show, but we'll have to comment on this last part here. It's so interesting. I don't know whether to start at the top or the bottom, but I guess go with the thing about women again that he ends up with, because I have something important to say here, I think. But first I'll just say that when he says that Chiang Kai-shek, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, made the decision to turn down Japan, was Chiang Kai-shek not alive at this time? Wasn't he there?
Certainly he was.
Well, that's what I thought. Well, why did he let his wife make these decisions? And tell the generals what to do and so on. What was wrong with him?
Yeah, you know, it's that is a very good question. And all that's mentioned right here is her extreme hatred of the Japanese, that she didn't want to do anything, that Japan was asking be done, even if it was would have been to the advantage of Chiang Kai-shek. And apparently her influence over her husband was such that he just kind of hushed up and let her sway
the day. Well, right. And, you know, she's known to be a very strong woman. And I guess she eventually took over, or he died or something, or he was killed or whatever happened. She was the big cheese for quite a while. But he must not have been much, and I don't see why he's not saying, complaining about Chiang Kai-shek and his ability to control his wife rather than blaming it on this woman. I don't know. And then Lola Montez, if Ludwig let himself be influenced by her, I guess that's his problem. So I think, you know, this reveals that one of the reasons that men have for wanting to hold women down and say women are not capable of this, that, and the other thing, is that it's because they fear women. No man wants to be seen as being told what to do by his wife or the woman in his life. Hitler certainly didn't want to. Hitler was really, I don't think he didn't want to ever have the people see him as being told what to do by a woman or being overly influenced by a woman or whatever, because he thought that was a great weakness, and he was very careful. He made sure that that Eva Braun, even once he kind of decided on her, was in the background and didn't have anything to say about anything. So that's part of that. Now, when he says that women, however intelligent, are not capable of dissociating reason from feeling in matters of a political nature. Well, he's pretty much narrowing that down to politics. So that's the only place where he's saying it. And, you know, I could go along with that. But I would like to say that this idea that only reason is what we should go by is not very good, because women, feeling is can also be called intuition, you know. I mean, and Hitler was very big on intuition himself. I mean, he followed his intuition all the time. And I think that this, what we call feeling, or what's often called feeling, is basically your intuition. And in my opinion, that is a superior quality to reason.
I agree.
Intuition is direct knowing. And women, maybe because women aren't as much thinkers as men or something, maybe they don't have the reasoning ability, although they have it, but maybe they just don't use it, or maybe they don't have it as good as well. So therefore, they're maybe more open to their intuition. I know a lot. I am, and I've discovered in my life that, actually, I'm not as open to it as I should be. I've discovered that every time I know I have that knowing from my intuition, it's exactly right. And I've always tended to question it and not follow it and say, oh, that can't be. What do I know about that? I can't know that. So, and then much to my detriment. So I do think that some of this, maybe women shouldn't be using, maybe you don't want somebody using intuition like this in politics, but actually Hitler did it himself. He used that, his feeling and his intuition about things, to make very, very important decisions. But he wanted to have it, you know, tried to have it backed up with facts and so on. But so a lot of this stuff is, it's okay, you know, I don't want to quibble over it, but I did want to say that. But, you know, I do want to also say before we, you go ahead and respond.
Well, I was just going to say, what you've just said is very, very important, because I think there are a huge number of men in particular, when they see that phrase, feelings, you know, can't separate reason from feelings, they're not thinking intuition, they're thinking emotion. And they think that a woman's emotional nature will override good reasoning. And so in that light, if they're thinking of that, well, a woman's not in control of her emotions near as much as a man is in control of his emotions, then they see that in the negative light in which, a lot of people address it.
Well, maybe he also means emotion. And it might be true that women are more emotional. I think a lot of women, you know, I find fault with a lot of women for being kind of emotional in a silly way, or being afraid of everything and, you know, getting all freaked out over this and that. I don't know if that's just partly the way they're brought up to feel like it's okay to do that or something, or if it's really there in women. I'm not sure. But anyway, you're right. The emotional thing is always brought up, and it there might be something to it, but I don't think it's as bad as a lot of men like to make out. Anyway, but Hitler talking about the artist, I have to say, so he may be right about everything, even when I disagree with him, but because he's definitely right about the artist, and everything I've ever experienced in the art world is exactly the way he says it is. And everything. I mean, I'd like to talk about it more, but it probably is not that important to other people. But the fact that we do fall, we have all fallen for this phony talk about art. And I can say from my own experience in art school, how I just believed everything. And then I saw, I can look now and see how everybody did, I mean, in general, because people think that these art experts, that there's such a thing, and that they know what they're talking about. And look what we've ended up with as art from following along with all of that stuff.
Right.
It wasn't so bad. It made a little bit of sense in the beginning, but look where we've gotten. And the other thing I want to say was this idea of stealing Jewish art. Yeah, that is so big and so makes, goes on and on today about how the Nazis stole all the art from the Jews.
Yeah.
And he's saying very well here that it was the Jews who were cheating everyone.
And the Germans took it back.
They had taken out, yeah, and the people, the Germans just took back what the Jews had taken fooling people. And they had gotten everything cheaper, and they were, well, whatever it was, I'm not describing it too well, but it was just what you just said, that they just took it back, and they had every right to do so. Every right to do so. I'm so sick of all that stuff that we hear about the Nazi art theft and so on.
That's right.
It's just disgusting. Okay, well, did you want to say any more?
Well, just one last thing, Carolyn. My book here, of course, and I'm reading the book, we have reached the halfway point from page 1 to page 724. We are halfway.
Well, good.
As far as the text goes, so, yeah.
Well, then, I'll just go ahead and say good night for us, ladies and gentlemen. This has been Hitler's Table Talk on October 2nd, 2014. And please join us again. This is Carolyn Yeager and Ray Goodwin bringing it to you, and join us again next week for episode 31 and the second half, beginning of the second half of the book. Good night, everyone.
Good night.